summary of how you see that connection. And feel free to write on the board, of course.
But I've definitely like to understand better the thing you was describing that Justin and Phil are doing about mm-hmm. geometric quantization in a categorical mm-hmm. sense, right? So I understand is the question of how do I obtain things like local operators, line defects, or whatnot out of a classical Lagrangian and some quantization.
Right.
So not sure what I should say in the sense that I mean, right? Clearly he was talking about quantum field theories, right?
Yes.
This is what we're all talking about in the paper. So which part of the translation between quantum field theory and what he says is what's...
That's a good question.
Some things I assume are common knowledge, some are clearly not, right?
Mm-hmm. Can
I form the question again? So somehow you want to. I mean, are you alluding to some particular part of Dylan's talk, or are you asking something which has nothing to do with Dylan's talk, or?
Maybe my question at the moment is: assuming I understood Dylan's talk, mm-hmm. should I have been able to derive what's in your paper, and if so, how?
So, when he talked about parameters of operators, mm-hmm. which is another name for the things he's done.
So, can I make a suggestion? Maybe, can maybe one of you just present some kind of your point of view on your paper? I think that will be the easiest.
You should only start.
How can
no, I? You want me to start? Yes, you want. My perspective is going to be the less mathematical.
I mean,
perhaps.
I can start. So,
and then we'll be watching to Ben if he can derive this from Bill's talk.
Since we have some so, for example, x might be some kind of symplectic quotient, then we can construct two aspects. So, this is kind of to explain themselves. So I put TFTs in quotes because depending on how you look at them, they might not literally be topological in some directions that are wrong. So if the A model or if you take sigma times or the solutions to your equations in motion.
Physical theory, right? And then
yes.
You have two different topological twists of this theory.
Yes.
And when I say that the solutions of equations of motions are this, what does it mean? That means that it means that if you live on sigma times r, then the space of classical solutions is going to be this.
Yes.
Okay.
Which preserves the topological supercharge.
Yes.
Well, I mean, there is some kind of so you're saying that the holomorph from sigma to x, they're wrong. Okay, fine. So kind of. Maybe it makes sense to make a remark that this is trying to be a this is trying to depend on sigma only on topology of sigma, which is not exactly the case, but it's kind of almost the case.
Exactly. Yeah. That's a kind of subtle point. Good. And the other one.
Sorry. Can you make it? This is a statement about classical field theory, right?
Yes.
So in classical field theory, an object like something sub Derham doesn't really usually appear. So when you say that equations of motions is this, what is the actual mathematical content of this statement? Is it?
Wow. Might be easier to try to see the half question one, and we see the word large.
Yeah. This is maybe a question that I would like to understand. So, what does it mean that the Derham stack appears as a space of classical solutions?
So, if you look at the half question version.
Sorry, Ben. I'm hoping I'm not.
Oh no! Please, everyone, feel free to hijack.
And we will see. There's some variance of sigma is not flat, so let's see that.
So when I say half twisted, it refers to what? I'm sorry.
It refers to a model because holomorphic is sigma, but topologically in order.
Topologically what? I'm sorry.
Topological in the order.
Okay.
So we're going to see trivialize the tangent model for simplicity, and then. Then this the moduli of solutions in equations of motion are maps from sigma across C.
So when I say maps, it just means just C infinity maps.
No, I mean algebraic maps.
Algebraic maps.
Algebraic or by the usual injunctions, you can read this as maps sigma x maps. And because this is like an equivalent thing, this is the tangent space.
Oh.
So you might recognize this. This is the thing that's kind of called the global stack.
No, this I can imagine because, I mean, I can imagine how something derived, some kind of derived object can appear as a space of solutions. Because, I mean, you're just solving some equations and, you know,
yeah.
This can be derived. I'm having more trouble, I mean, maybe this question is too precise, but understanding that when you're writing this whole, you know, sub Derham, is it important for you, I mean, do you distinguish here the fact that, I mean, say, topological local systems from algebraic local systems?
I'm not sure that's a level of detail I can really comment on, I mean,
if you sort of think about Derham in sort of topological sense, then I can again imagine how this, what the statement means at least. So somehow, if especially when X is a stack, which I think you want it to be a stack, and somehow
yes.
When you consider maps from something to that thing and Derham, this is, if you consider actually actual Derham in sort of algebraic categories, this thing is first of all pretty big and so
yes.
On. I mean, even if you consider sort of, even when sigma were a point, that would be kind of relatively,
yes.
Well, no, maybe not a point, but no, for a point maybe it's not complicated, but anyhow, so what I'm trying to say is that.
I feel like if you're happy with this, then you must be happy with the Derham stack, because this is almost the same thing.
Not really. Again,
this is
if you understand the Derham stack and the kind of naive sense. Depends whether it works sort of in topology or in algebraic geometry. Algebraic geometry. So let's consider an example. Suppose that V is a point. Suppose your X is just point one, it's just the classifying stack. Then what is this thing for you?
This
maps from sigma X Derham. How do
I think the best way to understand it would be this, like literally there were unstack and not unstack GPs.
Okay, well, I can't really understand how this can appear as a space of classical solutions, but...
Well, if you can understand, I mean, can you understand the statistics?
Yes.
So, the Rammstack is a small definition of this.
No, I don't agree with this somehow.
So let's first, a sheaf on this is a Higgs bundle on this space. So, if I do a small definition,
Maybe you're right. So somehow, think of like. Okay, let's ignore this. Sorry.
Okay. So you still so the thing on the left comes from first doing holomorphic and then a bit of topological.
Yes, exactly. It's kind of a small map. That's why.
If I had done just brutally topological from the beginning, I would have gotten something.
Probably you would have. I am not entirely sure. Maybe you would have looked at different class of sheaves. I mean, the thing I don't understand is there should be some kind of non-holomorphic PDE in solutions for counting.
Yes.
And stable solutions to that PDE should look like holomorphic transitive instruments.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know what that PDE is. So presumably if you just bootleg it topologically, you would find something about counting the number of solutions to a certain differential equation, which didn't go from the wrong.
Yes. Okay, so let's continue. So saying that in the A model, the space of classical solutions is this.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But you're saying that you don't really know how to prove the statement even classically because you don't know what the equations are.
Oh no, I mean, this you can do classically.
No, I mean, I'm talking about the left part of the board. You just said that, just something you said a minute ago. That's
okay. So the way I know how to prove it is first do this one, and then do a little deformation right in there. And Davide was asking, what if you just like looked right in the middle of this family? What would you find? And then you would find something about PDEs. I don't really understand that. And the B model. The solution is the equations in motion on sigma minus 4 are the same way. So what we so here, the point is here this is a shifted line on tangent space. So it has a so functions on this look like sections of the exterior powers, the cotangent level. So it has a little deformation right around the round thing. This guy here is maps T1 sigma. But X, I can in the same way perform this to maps sigma prime. So what we were studying in our paper is boundary conditions for these things, where on the boundary we completely break the topological nature and we just are left with a vertex algebra.
Can I say it a little bit more precisely? So a priori, a boundary condition for such a theory is what? It's what kind of mathematical object is it? Is it an object of some category? Is it an object of some two category?
Well, it depends on what boundary condition means.
Okay, no, that's exactly right. So do I think correctly that boundary conditions in this case are supposed to form a category?
Yeah.
No.
It's topological boundary condition.
Topological boundary
would form a category.
This is free. So I thought that, okay, so suppose you have a known as topological three-dimensional theory. Then there's a category can associate to a circle. It's a category. All right, so what does that category have to do with boundary conditions?
Well, it's kind of associated to a point. Two categories associated
to a point. It's boundary conditions. Then there's a map you can do that embeds these into the category attached to a circle.
But what you attach to a point is a two category.
Yes.
And when I'm saying that there's a map which to the category associated to a circle, what does that mean? Because I don't know what it means to map a two category to a category.
You're taking some kind of hotulomology along one direction or something. You're replacing morphism categories by their K theory.
Okay. Fine. So boundary conditions form topological boundary conditions form two category, but you're saying that the boundary conditions you want to study will be not topological.
Okay. It will be homomorphic.
And do those a priori form a category or not?
No.
Or two categories.
So the difficulty is, like, if you have topological boundary conditions, you can look at interfaces between them. Mm-hmm. But in the algebraic or homomorphic world, it doesn't really make sense to talk about curvilinear one things. You can't talk about factorization on the plane.
So what does it a priori mean to describe about such a boundary condition?
So what it means is I will write down some condition on my field, classically, and then study the operators in perturbation theory.
You can answer in line with what Dylan is saying is that if you see the bulk theory as an E1 algebra living in factorization algebras, then the boundary condition would be any one module for this E1 algebra.
Okay, can you just
write it? So Dylan talks about this. So this describes the tetraedic theory, right? I think the description is true for already here, right? This is already you need one
chiral category. Yes.
So okay, that's fine. So you're now going to give a mathematical definition of boundary condition of such a theory.
First, let's try to define what the homomorphic topological theory might mean mathematically.
Okay.
And I think it's at least you can extract from it any one algebra object in factorization algebras.
Yeah, so maybe it makes sense to say that E1 algebra in anything is the same as associative algebra, right? So it's just a factorization algebra with an additional associative algebra structure.
Yes.
And some coherences.
I'm sorry?
There will be some coherences.
Sure.
And what is the meaning of this? So this factorization algebra describes for you the local operators on a plane,
sure.
And then you can bring the operators on different planes together topologically.
Okay.
So you can imagine sort of your sliced your space-time.
This is fine. Yeah.
Right. So now if I have a holomorphic boundary, then it's going to be any one module object. Because
one module means in one factorization module or
in factorization matrix.
Okay, so it's a factorization algebra which has an E1 module, which is just has a kind of module structure in the stupid sense of the whole.
Yeah. And the explanation is very simple. This boundary condition supports local operators, so you can ask questions about local operators, which means this gives a factorization algebra, but it also allows you to take operators on the bulk and bring them down.
Okay.
So this data seems to capture only point-like things, but does it also capture line defects?
Well, if instead of saying, if you replace the word E1 algebra by category, so it was a factorization category, then it would capture line defects.
So you're saying I should, I should replace this whole thing with factorization category?
I think that would be a shock.
That's right. So essentially, if I do this, I'm only talking about local operators and boundary conditions. I'm not allowing myself to talk about topological lines.
Okay.
So perhaps this should be upgraded. So you call them factorization category?
Yeah.
So is it factorization category with, is it E1 factorization category or just factorization category?
Just factorization category.
But then I'm confused, what sense one is upgraded with the other?
Right.
Because if I have an E1 algebra object and factorization algebra, it's the category of left modules of the E1 algebra. forms a factorization category.
Wait, but just have a factorization algebra to get through. It's getting an E1 module, so because in principle any factorization algebra produces a factorization category, right? But you know, you can consider just factorization modules over it.
Yes.
But that's not what you're doing.
I'm just taking E1 modules.
Taking E1 modules. Okay.
So that's a faithful alternative. It's more faithful.
But
even modules, but not in this sense.
Wait, but then going right and going down is the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Hmm? But then literally going right and going down is the same thing.
No. Because this is an E1 module object in factorization algebras.
Sorry, not. I see. Okay. And so if the upgrade of that would be what?
Could be a factorization algebra object.
Okay.
That's fine. So I see. Just factorization. So you have factorization category, and then you just want factorization algebra. Okay, great, fine. Let me just repeat. So the statement is that the way to think about this holomorphic topological theories is just as a factorization category. And the boundary conditions are described by factorization algebra, not factorization algebra.
Mm-hmm.
That's the definition, basically.
Yes.
So sorry, let me try to. What is the I'm not sure I understood what the distinction between a factorization category and an module object was.
You can go from the left to the right. So you can produce a factorization category from E1 factorization algebra, but not every factorization category from E1 factorization algebra, but not every factorization category which will be produced in this way.
In physical terms, what is this factorization category supposed to be?
Is this objects and line operators?
So this is the line operator.
So I should be able to do this. Ask the following questions, right? I have these topological lines, which are kind of vertical.
Yeah.
Right. You can have points on the lines.
Mm-hmm.
This includes also the points in the bud, just for the trivial line.
Mm-hmm.
And then perhaps you can also have a boundary.
Mm-hmm.
And points at the boundary where this line meets the boundary.
Yeah.
So the collection of all of these pieces of information should be this factorization category, mm-hmm. together with the factorization algebra inside. That's what. Maybe you can expand on what the factorization category is. But. So the objects which have the lines, the morphisms are the points on the lines.
Yes.
And then you should be able to take two lines and bring them together.
Yes, with some poles.
With some poles.
So it's like
some,
a bifunctor with some poles.
Mm-hmm.
But unfortunately, it's never been very clearly pinned down. I mean, there's a very, very abstract definition of a factorization category by Gates, Green, and Sam Raskin, but I don't think there's any definition in like formulas.
Mm-hmm. What do you mean? The factorization categories, it is defined as it's not even very complicated.
Like, if you think, a factorization algebra, that's the same as a vertex algebra, it's very explicit.
Yes.
But the factorization category,
But what kind of, what would be the statement? The factorization category is the same as what?
Category with a bifunctor depending variable.
I think it would be very difficult to formulate this carefully.
Even
the notion of vertex algebra by itself is definitely too complicated for me. and here you need some kind of particular. I'm not saying it's impossible, but I'm saying that it's going to be pretty ugly, I think.
So in here we have not introduced, so the boundary condition is some extra structure you put on top.
Yes.
Okay. Can you tell me again what it is?
So the boundary condition would be a factorization algebra object.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Inside there?
Yes.
It's confusing too.
Yeah, so I think the issue here
like,
is.
The boundary should not be an object in here, right? Unless you're sort of wrapping into a line.
Yeah, I wouldn't.
There should be definitely a map.
Maybe it's a functor?
I think it wants to be a kind of a.
Sorry, but can we just, I mean,
it's
not part of the board.
That's right, sorry. I raise it because we're trying to upgrade it, okay?
No, but let's remember what we're upgrading. So you said, I mean, because, I mean, the producer some examples. So you said that, so is it still true that any E1 factorization algebra should produce, I mean, an example of what you want, and the way to produce it, you can see the category of E1 modules. Is that okay?
And but then, conversely, if I want to go back, I just take the identity line.
I think it's an issue of the size of the of. Because if I so what?
I don't think you can go back. Formally, I don't think practically. I don't see a way to go back. And if I have a factorization category, can you produce always E1 factorization algebra?
I should be able to just take the identity line, right? And then the more business of the identity line.
Ah, I see.
Can I ask a very, very pedestrian question about the thing you erased?
Yes, sorry.
What is an object in factorization algebras? Do you mean to, are you leaving off some words like the category of, or? I'm just trying to parse that.
What is the definition of factorization algebra?
Well, what is E1 algebra object in factorization algebras?
Well, basically, it means that it's factorization algebra, which has an addition associative algebra structure, which is compatible with factorization. That's all. I mean, you can, the word E1 can always be.
I was wondering, did you leave out some words, like the category of, or something like this?
I think you looked at the in the category of factorization.
Okay, that's all. Okay, just trying to orient myself.
Yeah, and somehow this is one of these things where, right, somehow there's always some picture that one draws. So in this case, this is sort of factorization algebra is something about what happens when points in this plane come together. It's sort of a something where you can multiply things by colliding points in the plane.
Yes.
And then the E1 thing is that you can sort of take things happening on two planes and smush the planes together.
Yes.
Yeah? Yeah, okay. So you were referring
the way I was thinking about this, that factorization algebra, just by definition, what is the date of factorization algebra? For any algebraic curve and any power of that algebraic curve, there's some sheaf on that power. And E1 means that this sheaf, in addition, has a fiberwise associative algebra structure, which is compatible with all the,
mm-hmm.
whatever, well, I mean, you have these sheaves on all powers of all curves, which are required to satisfy certain capabilities, and now we have a just fiberwise associative algebra structure, which is compatible with all this
Yes, so for every point on the surface or every little neighborhood on the surface, right, there is a whole cylinder where you can insert your local operators. And they can multiply along the cylinder.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. Now, so here, there is something like taking an homomorphism of identity or something like that I can send you here.
Yeah, except that I'm not sure why these procedures would be mutually inverse.
Actually, I trust this procedure more than the other. So from my point of view, the physical theory will give me this, and will give me this, and it's definitely true that from this I can get that by forgetting stuff.
Okay. Yes.
Reconstructing, it's okay. Much less obvious.
Fair enough.
Yes. Okay.
Right.
Okay, great.
So,
yes, okay, sure.
Identity line.
Yes, but you can also go back, but somehow not
so
everything on the right will be obtained by this procedure. That's fine, but at least it gives some examples.
That's fine.
And then, if I still stick to the sort of left part of the board, then you're still saying that the boundary condition would be an E1 module.
That's right. And now I'm trying to figure out what sits there that can fall down here.
Okay, so I think the confusion is the category of lines should be perfect modules over this E1 algebra, but the boundary condition will not be a perfect module. As I'm going to impose an infinite number of constraints on fields. So,
can I think about this as some kind of fiber functor in the E1 direction? No.
Yeah, no, I agree.
For each line, I should get the vector space of things that live at the end of the line.
Yes.
And the objects in here are the lines, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And this vector space should come with an action, of course, with an action of the morphisms.
Yes,
so it's a functor.
Yes.
And with the factorization algebra structure compatible with the one here. So I would have really said it is a fiber functor for whatever factorization category means.
To the category of factorization algebra.
That's right.
But then we can still apply it to identity.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And you get any one module, right?
Sorry. conflict. So before, so before there was a statement that a boundary condition is the same as a factorization algebra in this factorization category.
I don't like that.
Yeah,
so you don't
like that. I'm doing degree retabulating.
Okay, and so what is the right formulation?
I think it maybe you could factorize a functor of factorization categories to vect.
Okay.
And then we'll send the identity to a factorization algebra.
So it's a kind of dual object.
Yes, exactly. So I think it's a question of size.
Yeah. So if everything was kind of, if everything were dualizable enough, then it would be the same, right? But okay,
yes,
wait.
Maybe.
So if I just focus on the identity line, right? This is
okay.
Going to give me the one model.
So can I understand how this, if you go to the left, how an E1 module over that E1 factorization algebra gives you, is it just home, or this functor to vector is just home from it? I mean, do you just consider home from that module?
I only care about arrows this way, so I wouldn't answer
the question. No, but we're constructing an example. So.
Yeah, let's try to give examples of these things. I think it's the best.
Right, but I mean, I'm just saying, suppose that your factorization category is the category of modules over your E1 factorization algebra.
Mm-hmm.
Then, first of all, is it true that any factorization, any E1 module over your E1 factorization algebra will give you a boundary condition?
Let's see.
So you just and this functor to vector will be just home from that.
I think so.
Okay.
So
if you say so.
Would have to be in the correct category.
Okay. This is.
That's be home into it. Because if you take the identity of it.
Yes.
Because this E1 factorization thing on the boundary is what I'm supposed to get after applying this functor to vector.
Mm-hmm.
So I must be looking at Holmes into it, because it's the boundary operators.
Wait, if I take Holmes into it, then it means that your functor is contravariant.
Yes.
Is that?
Oh. But here, there's a duality, right? They're perfect modules of the E1 algebras.
I'm sorry?
You might hope there's a duality. These might be perfect modules of the E1 algebra I can take.
Yeah, actually, you could kind of have left and right modules, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So sure. We're sort of up and down boundary conditions. And and I say functor, but it is, so if I think about the lines going up, maybe boundary conditions on top are a functor to vect, covariant, but contravariant bottom boundary conditions. So it could be covariant or contravariant depending on boundary conditions on top or bottom. Right? In principle, the most general thing you can do is to consider a slab, right? In particular, if you give me a top boundary condition and the bottom boundary condition, I should be able to get a factorization algebra.
Okay.
Which is what's left of this becomes a two-dimensional system.
I mean, factorization algebra can be thought of as factorization functor from vect to vect. Right?
So
I would say it's not coherent or contravariant, but it's just the direction of the functor. So in one case, you get a functor to vect, in another case, you get a functor from vect. Isn't that true?
Maybe, yeah.
Because it's about, you know, I mean, if your line have...
I would prefer to think about it as a tensor product over... I mean, the analogy here should be sort of having a left module, a right module, and a tensor product.
Okay, no, that... Okay, that's also... Yeah, maybe this is more correct.
Because you give me a random vector space, I'm not going to be able to find it among the spaces of local operators.
Okay, fine. So this is what we mean by boundary condition.
That's right.
And so let me ask you a question. So this is all about this kind of half-twisted, what we call half-twisted
right.
theory.
So for this, you should...
And you actually want to do it not for half-twisted, but for fully twisted theory.
Well,
you just regard
seen as the formations of a half-twisted theory, which means that we're looking, from this point of view, we're looking at some situation where this E1 algebra simplifies a lot. But the E1 module does not simplify.
I see. So in other words, your theory is kind of fully twisted, sort of fully topological, but you forget part of the structure. You only regard that as this kind of holomorphic topological theory.
And this allows me to talk about holomorphic boundary conditions of a topological theory.
So can we say, so you said what are the spaces of classical solutions in A and B model, can we say what are the factorization categories in this case? In order to formulate what it means to look for a boundary condition, according to what they just told us, we need to identify those factorization categories.
So we should use this thing we didn't talk about it all.
I might even know the answer, but I want to hear it from you. So.
Is it an exam?
No, it's not an exam. It's I'm examining myself. So.
So how the lines do?
Suggest an answer, but I don't know if that's
So you said that if you have a minus two shifted symplectic bar, then you can get a composition category.
A category. This example.
For me, it's actually easy to produce the answer for fully twisted ones, but I can see it easily, relatively easily, how to produce composition categories. But so maybe actually for this one.
Let's go to the algorithm, right? Take the puncture formal disk, and look at what space I get.
Mm-hmm.
And this thing's already symplectic.
Mm-hmm.
So the tangent bundle is the same as the cotangent bundle. So this is like T star 1. So this is evidently plus one shifted symplectic.
So the metabolization is going to give a category?
Yes, exactly. So it looks like the B model.
And that's how you get the compensation structure from the fact that
So the category is what again?
Well, to produce the category, I should take my...
Over a point, so to say. What is the category?
Wait, this is going to be the category of points.
Yes.
So I should look at this space, and I polarize it. And I should look at sheaves on the base of the polarization. So there's just like geometric polarization is all good and hard for the science.
So I'm confused. So where are you using symplectic structure on X?
I used that to identify this.
Only at that point.
Right.
I see.
So one answer would be that the category of should just be something like was it covariant sheaves on the U stack of X. This is the half cast.
Okay.
As you say, it's huge.
Is it a factorization?
Oh, no, it's okay.
Is this a factorization category?
Well, more or less, yes. I mean, it's kind of easy to say what is deformations for that case. So I think that, I mean, what I was going to say that in this deform cases,
mm-hmm.
I was going to say that
you consider here. In this case, I guess you want to consider. So one thing that you have to understand,
So in this case, you want to consider the following category. You want to consider neon patients loops into the back. So this is made from a formal puncture disk, and then you want to consider D modules.
Maybe you need D modules. I think your X. My X might be the
cotangent. Sorry. Sorry. I can only say the answer if X is a cotangent bundle of some way.
Yes.
Otherwise, I don't know what it is.
Exactly. So that's the same as what I get here by doing a slightly different polarization.
Yes. And I don't know how to say this if you don't have that. And here, under the same assumptions, actually,
I would say that you would get something like quasi-coherent sheaves, although I still have confusion that it's quasi-coherent or incoherent, but let's not worry about that right now. So this is just, let's say, maps from neo notation Durand function disk to so on. Okay.
I
don't really understand mathematically very well in what sense one is the permission of the other. It's kind of maybe intuitively clear, but what it means exactly, this is...
I think if I had chosen a better polarization, I think I would have got to what you had.
I could say if X is simple, is a cotangent bundle, then you can...
Y, then we can view the whole thing as like T star of 1 of maps of T of 1 of your disk, Y. So I'm getting a cotangent bundle from this guy. And then when I quantize, I would do this and consider QC. And this has two deformations. QC maps under disk to RAM. Y and...
I kind of have a problem with the statement, but there's one being permission of the other.
That the classifying space of the tangent bundle form of the
RAM? No, the fact that what you're writing now is a deformation.
That this is from here to here?
We'll have to be a little more careful. So it's a deformation, the following. So I would say, let me say some sentence. I have a problem with that sentence too, but still, I think that it's deformation in the following, first of all, in the following sense, that the category half up there is supposed to have two Z gradings.
Yes.
And each deformation will only commute with one of them.
That's correct.
So it's not true that these two these are two kind of derived categories. The two sort of derived categories you have on the bottom, as derived categories, are not deformations of the same thing.
That's right. So some of my ones should have been minus ones. There are some shifts here.
Well, it depends what you mean by grade. Essentially, it means that you have two gradings and sort of.
So, I think this was related to a question I had asked about Dylan's talk, which is. He said, I'm going to look at the A side and the B side. And on one side, he said, assume this is two-shifted symplectic. And on the other side, he said, this is symplectic. In Dylan's talk, somehow this issue was there in that there was sort of one, there are two things he sort of claimed were dual, and he had different input data, right? One where something was two-shifted and one where it was zero-shifted. And I think this is exactly the second grading.
No, maybe, but the point is that this. So, in order to dual this, so basically, I think that if you start with an arbitrary symplectic stack, you can't really define the same models. That's the first thing. You need some additional data, and the additional data is something like, you need something like action of the multiplicative groove, which dilates the symplectic form. And if you have that, that allows you on this category, which you have, and this kind of half twisted theory exists always, but this additional action on a multiplicative group, it allows you to produce a second grading on this category corresponding to the half twisted theory, and then you can write these deformations, but each deformation expects only one grading.
Well, these sorts of C star actions, right?
So this is kind of because, in the end, it means that the two categories are going to get so trying to be casualed. Well, so there's deformation, but if you forget about this deformation, they're kind of trying to be casual dual rather than equivalent.
Right. Well, that's like the last 10 years of my life.
But I formally, I don't have to raise this question, but I think that.
Did you still put that dr outside the parentheses?
It doesn't matter, not to the draw stack.
Oh, okay.
The single conjunction.
Okay. Sorry.
I still have some kind of problem with this. I think it's a little, it's kind of fine as a slogan, but it's a little bit to make for the following reason. Let's consider an example when your Y, let's say, is the classifying stack of some group. Then, if you consider, so then actually, you know, this one of them really doesn't. Maybe in some formal sense a deformation, but really doesn't look like a deformation. So if you, this one is going to be sort of much bigger than this.
I really don't see it.
Let's just look, because here you're going to, let's
assume. Is it due to the party of the shift?
No. I mean, it's not about shifts. I think kind of what I'm trying to say that this only knows about the formal neighborhood of the trivial of the system.
So the only thing I feel like I want to use is the kind of Hochster Hausmann sequence.
But again, here, the point is that, okay, so let's just look what's written here.
Yes.
So why is point much?
So it's maybe not relevant for if you want to use it for motivation part, but if you want to use other reverse that. If you can see the maps from D star Durham to point G, then by definition, this is sort of G local systems of D star, right? Also G bundles. With connection. Mm-hmm. So this by itself is a pretty complicated space, and kind of set theoretically it is big. Whereas, what do you have here?
Keep the key bundle to the Higgs field.
Yes, but that's much smaller.
Why is that much smaller?
That's easy to see because okay, let's consider an example. Consider G to be GL1. Well, it's, I don't know if smaller. Well, first of all, sorry, it's not what I keep. First of all, you have already the sheet. This is important. And also, if you didn't have the shape, if you didn't have the shape, it would maybe be rather bigger than smaller. I mean, if you get something out of GL1, then you can see this quotient of connections by Gaussian formations. And so,
it's so disturbing.
Gaussian formations in the case of GL1, if you get it on Higgs fields, that would be trivial.
If I start saying with true gradients, the categories would depend a lot on what I call the cohomological thing.
Certainly, but I thought that here. I thought that here you're doing the simple minor thing if you go from here to this one. Because I thought you actually want to say that just. You're kind of trying to say that the space, if you don't consider the category, but just the space itself, is a deformation of this space.
So you wouldn't agree that the module net local systems is a deformation of the Higgs bundles?
But I don't see Higgs bundles here, frankly.
So is it because it was a more like modulable Higgs bundles or something like that?
Well, I mean, if you have the shift by one, and I thought that.
So if this shift by one was a classifying space of the tangent bundle, then it would literally be Higgs bundles. But I could see there's an issue about am I looking at the classifying space of the tangent bundle or a completion?
Okay, maybe this is too precise for the discussion, but I feel like there's some issue here which I don't understand, but it's okay.
I mean, I do say, yeah. I mean, depending on how you look at all these symbols, you might pop out with a formal completion of the experience.
I kind of have less of a problem with the second one from this point. But, okay.
Now, can we give also examples of boundary conditions?
So I think now we're ready to sort of discuss what your paper is about, right? Now we kind of set up the language.
So let's try to make some nice boundary conditions. What are good factorization functors to X for this T star 1 maps from D to X?
So let me ask a general question. So what do you want to achieve? So you want to construct some boundary conditions on both sides, which are in some sense correspond to each other?
No.
If
you want to do symplectic duality,
yes,
then you're going to look for boundary conditions which become topological too, after the twist.
Okay.
And then you'll be able to find boundary conditions that can go both ways.
Okay. But you want to do something else?
I want to find boundary conditions which remain holomorphic.
But that means that leave only on one side, so either on B's, A side or B side.
It's like most of them are not compatible with both twists. So they have a condition which can be deformed one way, but not the other. So we're never trying to do a mirror symmetry for this kind of boundary condition.
Okay, fine. But
instead,
but
you want to use them in the sense that I have this boundary condition, and perhaps I can try to reconstruct the bulk from the boundary condition. And the bulk reconstruction exercise should be the same.
But so your formal goal is to give examples of boundary conditions, some examples on A side, some examples on B side. Is that what?
There should be any boundary condition on A side. One theory should be a boundary condition on B side.
Of the other theory, yes.
The other theory.
Yes.
So that's so.
Of the other means
the mirror
dual
theory.
Okay,
yes.
That's fine.
So if you can find mirrors, it would be nice. What I meant is that you don't have the same boundary condition here that can be brought on both sides. And
okay,
here.
Fine. So now we want to give examples of boundary conditions. So will it be on A side or on B side?
So let's start with the topological ones, because I think those are easier.
Okay.
Topological ones should be associated to Lagrangian submanifolds in X. Can you think of how to use a Lagrangian submanifold in X to get a nice functor there?
In X or in something like loops into X?
In X.
In X.
Well, I mean, you mean before the deformation or after?
Before the deformation.
Well, I mean, the only thing I can think of is that you can try to consider maps into this Lagrangian.
Mm-hmm.
This Lagrangian, I consider.
That's right.
So the boundary condition was supposed to be, yeah, so actually, first of all, let's say one thing which we didn't say. So our theory is supposed to be a factorization category. Factorization category
exactly.
Is just this quasi-Cayenne sheaves on the space of maps from
D1, D star to Y.
Sorry, when you write sequence, so how do we think about factorization categories? So kind of one easiest thing to produce is what it gives over a point. So somehow a factorization category in particular has a fiber over a point of a curve. So
mm-hmm.
The fiber over a point of the curve will be this thing when your sigma is a puncture disk, if I understand this correctly.
Yeah.
So in other words,
so these are the lines in a sense of this.
So if you want to produce, for example, this thing over a bunch of points, then somehow we need to sort of consider formal puncture disk near those points and consider maps from products of maps from those.
So I think the simplest way to look at it is, like, if we take x instead of y, and look at the half twist, then factorization.
No, that this is what we're doing, right? I mean, I'm
just factorization kind of moving like sheaves on space, and then these functors we get by like, lead functors.
Okay, so your sheaves on the loop space of X, this is your factorization category over a point.
Yes.
Okay, fine. So like now,
suppose I give you a Lagrangian in X and a sheaf of a loop space in of X. How do you get a vector space? I want to take some home.
So now there's an issue if you want a covariant functor or contravariant functor.
Either way. I should be able to both get an up boundary condition and down boundary condition.
Well, I mean, I don't know what you want. I mean, for example, the following thing kind of makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
You can consider just loops into this Lagrangian.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And then I can see the structure sheaf of that.
Yes.
And then I can consider the home either from that or into.
That's right. That's a reasonable.
But here, I don't see why it needs to be Lagrangian, for example.
Yeah, that's to be compatible with the perimeter conditions.
Oh, so if you don't want deformations, then you don't need the stupid
yes,
no, that's right. But if you pick a Lagrangian, then it will be compatible with both deformations, and it will give you something topological. That's what I claim.
So if you pick something isotropic, it's compatible with one, I think.
That's right.
Co-isotropic with the other, if I remember.
It seems
correctly.
Okay, this I can believe. Okay, so to produce some examples of boundary conditions.
Yes.
So these are boundary conditions which you can deform in both directions.
Yes.
Okay, now but your paper is about something different.
Yes, it's about boundary conditions which can be deformed only in one direction and give you a nice precursor.
So in which direction do you want to deform, A or B?
Pick one.
So that means condition. That your paper has two independent parts?
That's right, two independent parts.
Okay. Which are twistable. A part and the B part.
That's
okay.
Right.
So A is the first letter of the alphabet, so let's do A.
That's right. So on A we are supposed to land on... is this the COH side? I don't know.
You chose a very confusing terminology.
I'm sorry.
So A would be what you call H to this. The space filling, right?
That's right. So in this case, we take X itself as the one isotropic manifold.
Yes.
And we can try to figure out what the answer is to after the deformation. But we know it's going to be the beta gamma system. It wants to be the beta gamma system. Well, why?
Yes.
Okay, so technically your paper is about some vertex algebra. So this vertex algebra will appear for A on A side or on B side or on both sides.
Both sides.
Exactly.
So the point is that when the bulk is topological.
What does the sentence mean?
So you have this factorization category.
Yes.
How do I recognize that it's actually a topological field theory, not an holomorphic topological one? It's a question.
So the answer, it's like strongly strongly A1 translation invariant condition.
Okay. So in practice, it will never be so, right? I mean, it will be only infinitesimally so.
Yes,
sir. Yeah. Right. So when you have that condition on the bulk, the boundary might still be an interesting factorization algebra, right?
Okay.
Which is not translation invariant.
So I'm confused again. So at some point you said that you don't want the boundary to be a factorization algebra, you want it to be something else, some kind of functor.
It's a functor from the factorization category to vector spaces, but the value of this functor on the identity object.
Well, the value of the identity is a factorization algebra.
Right. And it becomes actually a vector algebra, but only the value of the algebra.
Okay, fine. I mean, yeah.
It has a T.
Right, it only has a T, the value of the algebra. How do you prove that?
Sure.
It also has a zero sort of action, but you want it to be inner, so it's something about the center being small enough.
Okay, there's a physical expectation, which probably...
In other words, you want to say the following, that in principle, if your theory is not topological, when you say all this, then you actually have to fix this Riemann surface sigma, and sort of the whole discussion kind of depends on sigma. And if the theory is topological, then there is a compatibility between... Topological gives some kind of compatibility between different sigmas.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And so this is what... And that's exactly what you need in order to construct a vertex algebra.
Yeah.
It's good. In balance on Drinfeld terminology, that's the difference between chiral algebra and vertex algebra.
Right.
So chiral algebra, this notion of chiral algebra, and a vertex algebra is an algebra which kind of universally functorially used on every curve. Okay.
So we get an actual vertex algebra.
Okay.
Once the bulk is topological.
Fine. So now you're saying that you have some interesting examples of such boundary conditions which only deform in one direction.
Yes.
By the way, if I go to the previous discussion, then if they deform in both directions, Fermi is completely topological, still have some factorization algebras.
But but they're
some vertex algebras. I'm sorry?
So the actual algebra becomes for me.
So the actual algebra, oh, so you see, seeing the actual community of algebra.
Exactly.
Or, and, okay, fine.
And I think definitely interesting questions you can ask then if you do things like a slab, where I put an holomorphic boundary condition on the bottom and a topological one on top. There is definitely a nice interplay. I don't want to forget the Lagrangian, this topological boundary condition, because it probably plays important role in certain
extent. Okay, and so the statement is that we get some factorization, some vertex algebra, and not only get a vertex algebra, but you know, a factor from your factorization category to modules over that vertex algebra.
That's right.
This is the thing that.
Yes.
And.
And
which you also find, in some nice cases, will be an equivalence, right?
So it's clear that every object in factorization category will give you by construction.
But so the point is that in some kind of really nice cases, you expect this function to be an equivalence, right?
Yes. I don't know under which ones.
Yeah,
we don't. It's never been very clear for me.
No, okay, I understand. This could be. So. Okay, so let me summarize. So somehow we discussed what it means to have a sort of half-twisted theory and what it means to have a topological theory in the language of factorization categories. And we discussed what it means to have a boundary condition there. So there's a notion of topological boundary condition, and there's a notion of this kind of holomorphic topological boundary condition.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is kind of setting up the language. And you're saying that, and this is kind of, I don't know, I would call it kind of half topological boundary conditions, so one which deforms in one direction but not in the other. And so you're saying that such a thing will produce a vertex algebra.
Yes.
And so you want to construct some interesting examples of those.
It's actually a generic construction of those things. For every G mod V, or every V mod G, pretty much.
So for every V mod G,
you
construct one particular example, or?
You construct a collection of related examples. So on one side, which I don't remember if it's A or B, right, you need to pick this other vector space, W, call it however you want.
For the fermions?
For the fermions,
right, that's
to cancel some gauge anomaly.
Mm-hmm.
And there might be multiple Ws, which are these. Something you want the Casimir of G on V minus the Casimir of G on W to be equal to the Casimir of G.
I actually know this, but I'm not sure that other people know. I don't know if you want to write it or not. So. I don't know if we should write it or not, because I actually know what you're saying. But
I start writing as soon as you guys decide which was the in B. Sorry.
I know. Let them decide.
Well, no, I don't know. I think the thing that's still bothering me is sort of, okay, so. You know, I mean, this has all been very interesting. There is a certain amount of, I still have a lot of trouble connecting this to what is actually written in the paper.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, somehow.
I think this is a prerequisite to what's written in the paper. So I mean, it's probably not.
Which means that, like, you know, somehow, I mean, is there an earlier paper in which this picture appears?
Who wrote this paper with physics? So we didn't
want
to put in all this derived stuff,
which we just put it. Mm-hmm. This is a formalization of a certain degree of physical intuition or knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
Right? The fact that in the holomorphic topological theory we'll have topological line and holomorphic dependence of local operators and so on are just things we are saying here in a more formal way. Right, they were sort of prerequisite. Now, for the actual calculations, right. So on one of the two sides, first you need to understand the case where G is trivial. That helps.
Mm-hmm.
And so you just take G trivial, you see that it's a very simple boundary condition, which gives you beta gamma system at the boundary. So it's a very for every symplectic V, you can define a certain vertex algebra. Very, very simple. It OP, so sort of x, y, it's some constant. And this is just the answer. And then when you put on G, you argue that there is something called a BST reduction, which is a manipulation you do to this. On the other side, there is an analogy to Samuel's theory, which is very helpful. So actually, perhaps it would be helpful to discuss the factorization category for Chen-Simons theory first.
That would be fine, yes.
So, suppose we take Kasdan-Lustig, right, for integral level. No, not Kasdan-Lustig.
Sound right to me,
Heather? So, you take Kasdan-Lustig for an integrable level?
Also, yeah.
Right, mm-hmm. That's a factorization category. Which should describe Chesamon's theory.
Mm-hmm.
And then the boundary conditions correspond to.
Well, there's one we know about.
That's right. How do you describe it in the language of the functors to vectors?
It's really such a good help.
So we're trying to describe Chesamon's theory in this language.
Well, Chesamon's theory has been a mystery for me since 1991.
Well,
I'm understanding what it means in any context.
It's very hard to describe in the fully extended language, precisely because it does not have topological boundary conditions. But it has holomorphic boundary conditions, so this language is suitable.
Well, but as you just taught us, the first thing you should describe is a factorization category.
That's right. So let's take Kasdan-Lustig at integral level, at integrable, positive integral level. I want modules of.
Okay, so now Lustig or integral modules, probably. You probably want to take integral modules.
Okay, for any rational CFT, right, I could say I take the factorization category of modules of this CFT.
Okay. Right? So you take the category of integral modules on certain levels, so this is a factorization category, and then what is the question?
Well, and then the boundary condition, the obvious boundary condition is that you attach to each object the actual module.
You've used a module for the company.
So I'm confused. This is an answer to what question?
Describe Chesamon's theory in this language.
I'm not sure I understand the word describe.
So it means like give a factorization category and a factorizable functor corresponding to Chesamon's theory and Casimirian theory.
Sure. So I thought that when you want to describe the theory, then, I mean, in your language, then factorization, just describing a theory is the same as to describe a factorization category, period.
Yes. Okay. So
you just did that. So then what is the further question?
Well, if I describe it as the factorization category of modules of a vertex algebra, I've automatically also given a functor to that. So I gave both a theory and a boundary condition.
Okay.
Now, of course, but this is here we cheated. We should do better. We should just describe Chesamon's theory in a gauge theory language.
Mm-hmm.
So how would you, what you do when you really reconstruct your geometric quantization?
Again, Chesamon's theory is not a theory of this type, isn't it?
Well, if you do,
it doesn't come from a holomorphic symplectic state.
Well, but the B twist of some theories look a lot like Chesamon's theory. Actually, if I take point mod G, you get something which, okay, it's not Chesamon's theory.
You bundle to point mod G.
Yes, you get Chesamon's theory for the compatible G extension.
Yes.
Do shift.
Sorry. Let's
look at this.
So I think that Chesamon's theory is a special case of what's going on here.
Chesamon's theory for the cotangent bundle of G.
What does it mean for the cotangent? I thought there was just one Chesamon's theory per group. I mean,
it's like, now take the group.
Per group and an integer.
It's like, now take the group which is the cotangent bundle of another group.
So like G times G star. The second G was the algebra.
Okay.
Then these should look a lot like. So suppose if I take how would you write this if x is just
point where g.
If x is point where g, or y is point
where g? It's y point where g, sorry. How would you like this?
Before deformation or after?
After.
Well, that's actually, I mean, this one will be just the space of maps, will be just the space of g local systems on the formal function on this.
Sorry, so you say to call what did you say?
Just local g local systems on D star.
Okay. Now how do I see that this transformation is theory for tangent bundle of the group? What if I just done G bundles on D star? Would it be?
Well, the G bundles on D star is a kind of is a strange thing. I mean, it's a kind
Is there any way to get Cartan loose thick or something like that as from the finder smile or something like that?
In this example, there's a representation of the Cartan that we've been able to train this out like. Because if you just look at, if you get a bit of all complications, then this model is by G with G, where G is an algebra. Then it's sort of geometric representations, geometric sheet on G star, and by cultural duality, representations of G star.
So can we just, we should be able to just guess what the transfer is for transformers theory, right?
For G star?
No, just, I want to do this for transformers theory, right? So here, we're saying modules of vertex algebra, right? But there is a way to get the integral representation, the WSW model, right, is from something on the finance mind. What do? You do global sections or something on the finance mind?
You get the vertex algebra from something on the finance mind.
Yeah, what is
it? So you look at the global sections of the line bundle on the finance mind. So that is, fits into this geometric quantization picture by studying phase space on the hemisphere.
This side.
That's the phase cotangent bundle on the finance mind. Twisted by that line.
Right. So we should be able to go one categorical level higher, right?
Yes.
If you give me a one shifted cotangent.
Wait, can I ask you about that? In principle, you kind of at least appealed here at some point to classical theories. In classical theory, so we discussed, this point that you're writing some Lagrangian, and then somehow we're doing something with it. And the whole point was that this is not just about some arbitrary 3D theories, but it was about this 3D and equal 4 theories.
Exactly.
Now, if you just write the usual Chern-Simons Lagrangian, it doesn't have any supersymmetry at all.
No, this
one. I'm sorry?
This one.
So how do you turn Chern-Simons theory into a theory with big amount of supersymmetry?
No, it's the other way, right? You take the theory with a lot of supersymmetry, you twist it, most stuff drops out, and what you're left can look like Chern-Simons.
I see.
What are the questions motion for Chern-Simons?
Oh, I see. So you're saying that after certain twist, so this kind of supersymmetric theory, after a certain twist can just, it's after topological twist, it can become equivalent to Chern-Simons.
That's right.
So you're saying it's Chern-Simons theory for the cotangent bundle of the group, I'm not sure.
Let's start with no group. If you just have V, you get Chern-Simons theory for a group which only has fermionic generators. Something very silly again, Lie algebra, which is only fermionic generators.
V really has to be symplectic. Okay, so Chern-Simons theory. For Chern-Simons theory, you need a group and an invariant form of the Lie algebra, right?
That's
integral,
right.
Invariant form of, well, integral in some sense, invariant form of the Lie algebra. So you're saying that if your group is purely odd, then it's just a vector space, it's just a symplectic vector space.
That's right.
Okay. Yeah, this I understand, but
if you add G, then you can define a very nice Lie algebra out of G, V, and G dual.
G, V, and G dual, what is it?
It's this guy that keeps coming up.
So G and V dual. V1,
which is down. Oh, so it's a DG in the algebra.
Yes. This guy has a V bracket. He has an obvious V bracket with everything. And the V bracket here, between here, is divided into
V1, V2 is the moment map, I see. And the bracket of G2 on V is 0?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, it's the manual. Okay, fine. And
so the point of this.
And you're saying that also this has an initial vector 4.
Right. So this is the, if I look at the tangent complex.
Okay, so you're saying that, so if you take this DG group, then the Chern-Simons theory for this DG group is.
I think the grading goes away when you do the V-twist.
So Chern-Simons theory exists on the integral level. So what?
Here you get the very specific level.
So you're saying that this Chern-Simons theory for some particular level is equivalent to either A or B. B twist.
And when you do the B,
will be the level.
Everything will leave in degree 0.
That's right.
Well, as I there are two different gradients you can use on this. When you do the B-twist, you use a certain grading as a homological grading. Well, that's not that.
Okay, but what is the level?
The level doesn't matter, right? Because there's a C star action scale in this particular form.
No, but you have the sort of in degree 0,
have you? No, the pairing is 0 on the degree 0 part. Pairing this pair is G and G star.
No, but then there is a one loop effect. The geometric quantization gives you a correction to the level.
So it has nothing to do with, I see.
So you're saying that this Chern-Simons theory is
classical.
Is the topologically twisted thing. Okay.
So the affine Westmanic for that group is going to happen.
So we have the sums are described as the global sections of a line bundle and a finite manual.
Wait, but in Chern-Simons theory, the usually kind of traditional Chern-Simons theory, the vertex algebra is supposed to be the integral quotient of the Kac-Moody algebra. Mm-hmm. So what is then the statement here? So here you're saying that
A better definition, right, is that it's global sections of some line bundle and a finite manual.
Okay, that's the cool.
Use that definition, but for Berkeley algebra, and there is a good chance that you get the correct answer.
And is this what you're doing on the paper?
Well, we want. We had trouble with the globalization, so we studied the Kac-Moody version, and we didn't really know how to globalize.
But this is some group. I mean, what is the group? But the group structure here. I mean, okay. So this is the Lie algebra, but the group is really sort of in degree zero. So you have your group. So it's kind of non-trivial group topologically, so to say.
But you should think of this guy. This Lie algebra is a tangent space of this reduction, right? So the thing that's replacing VG is now some other quotient.
That's fine, but you wanted to take sections of some long bundle on the affine Grassmannian.
Yeah. So what's the affine Grassmannian? It's maps, kind of relative maps from V star V. E.g., now we take instead, we look at Robert maps from here to this guy.
Okay, that's fine. Yeah.
So we got something a lot like half of the space you studied elevators.
It's not half of the space because, this V is not, V is the symplectic guy in a way.
V is the symplectic,
So it's kind of bigger than what was there.
We also need to be
because, well. In our case, we're kind of writing that V was a potential bundle to something, and then, but that's fine. But so you're taking this, and now on that thing, so this is something leaving over the actual affine Grassmannian of G,
yes.
And now on that thing you want to define some kind of determinant line bundle.
Yeah.
So, sorry, can I just ask what you actually mean by relative maps?
The pairs of pair of map because it's a spec.
Mm-hmm.
He points out an equivalence, so it's a map from the disk with an equivalence to the base point of the
disk. I would say that it's two maps from the actual disk, non-punctured disk, which are identified on the punctured disk.
No, it's only one map, because when we're not doing modulo, because you don't get the vacuum module.
Oh, so no, doesn't so oh, it says D star D. Okay, that's fine. So yes, yeah, so you have a map from
map from the disk with an identification of the trivial map.
Yeah, so it's okay, so it's a map from the disk with a trivialization of that map away from a point, which is again for when the target is a stack, it's a structure, not a property. If the target were a scheme, then that would just mean that you're just considering just fixing the map away from a point, which is the same as to fix the whole map. But if the target is a stack, that means that you consider.
The issue with the scheme is derived predictions.
Yeah. Okay. That's also true.
So this definition just could never compute it.
But well, I mean, it's not the definition yet because you also need a line bundle. I would say that line bundle is supposed to be something like trivial because I mean, if it were not trivial, then you kind of told me that the level doesn't matter here.
But that they put it that there's like on a field variable is a loop correction, so that the line bundle will be related to the value of the quadratic Hausdorff. So you pull that line bundle back
from
the upper
Hausdorff. Well, so should I interpret this in the following way that if the value of the Casimiran V is correct, then we can define this line bundle to actually be trivial. And if the value is not correct, then we actually cannot define it.
No, line bundle. No, you can also define the line bundle.
Yeah.
But so if V is the cotangent, if V is G plus G star, then the line bundle would be trivial. But otherwise, look at the difference in value of the case.
I mean, I think the geometric quantization should give this like bundle.
But okay, so let's consider an example when V is. So saying that if V is cotangent bundle to something, then you're saying that the line bundle will be trivial.
No, V is the cotangent bundle
to
the adjoint.
To the adjoint. And if not, then what do, I'm actually confused though.
So I think you just look at the value of the quadratic Casimiran V and subtract off twice the value of VG.
So do you pull back the line bundle from left and right minor?
Yes, I put it to that power.
I see. Oh, so it's just pull back of some particular determinant bundle from the grass minor and you take its global sections on this guy.
For example, the simplest example I know is that where V is T star C and G is U1. So the Lie algebra becomes essentially U1/1.
But do we want in general to say that this, so that presumably this is the definition, but alternatively you can define it by means of some BRST reduction?
No, I mean, if you have the mirror theory, then it appears to be potentially the case. Well, no, it's still not obvious.
Sorry, so you define this algebra. So this algebra is supposed to be boundary condition for, it's supposed to be coming from boundary conditions for what kind of theory? For half twisted, A twisted, or B twisted?
This is B.
This is B.
Yes. So it factors life in half twist, the form to be twisted survives, and it gives you a vertex algebra, which is this.
So for any X which is of this form, you have this construction.
Yes.
Or in fact, it doesn't even have to be with this form. It's for any, I mean, you only use the X itself, right? So any X has a particular bound. They're saying that any X in the kind of B-twisted theory has a particular boundary condition, so, such that the corresponding vertex algebra is this.
Yes.
Is what it's associated to a point X.
Okay. So now, do you want to say that they can also define some other boundary condition in A-twisted theory so that under mirror duality, one goes to the other.
Not obvious.
So, the abelian case.
For the abelian case, yes. For the non-abelian, maybe.
So what about this BRST reduction? What is it trying to be?
So here, this is one boundary condition, right? There are other boundary conditions you could do. For example, you could just take Dreyfus local reductions by some subalgebras. You get other boundary conditions.
Like versions of W algebras for this.
That's right. Those In a lot of mirror situations, I believe that the regular reduction on one side goes to the sort of simplest VRST reduction on the other. But see, the point is, you need you need more than mirror symmetry between two theories, right? You need to also have a mirror symmetry between boundary conditions. And that dictionary has not been fully developed. So, now, in principle, you can hope that all of these different vertex algebras will give you the same bulk, that they are the same algebra, the same category of modules. But even that is slow.
So this guy you're talking about down here with the relative maps, what's the Lagrangian I should think about? And is there some corresponding Lagrangian?
Yes. It's not literally going to be a Lagrangian. It's a manifold. It's going to be something isotropic.
Okay.
What? Yeah, I mean, of course, it's associated to an isotropic manifold of X given by a point X. So maybe in this picture, you'd have maps from here which land at a point. There's probably some conormal directions, but just give you the rest of it.
Okay. Direct point in X or point in Y?
No, it's associated to a point in X.
Mm-hmm.
So why am I confused? I think I understand my confusion. So if you look at this example,
mm-hmm.
So like the half twist,
yeah.
So then QC on the loop space of X is going to be lines, and the trivial line, the identity line, is going to be the structure sheaf on maps
mm-hmm.
in the whole disk of X.
Mm-hmm.
And so this guy is probably going to be related to maps from the puncture disk to a point. But the way we associate a vector space.
Who's related to maps from the start?
This boundary condition.
I see.
And the way you associate a vector space is to
maps from the start to point is point, isn't it?
Yes. We look at maps from this sheaf to the other sheaf. So that's clearly going to be something about a map from D to X trivialized away from the point.
Sorry, maybe. So which point? I mean, so when you're saying maps from the start to point, it means that you need to choose a point on the X.
Yeah,
right?
So this boundary condition is associated to a point. In the case of
the point zero, so that.
Yeah, here we wrote it for the point zero.
And you're saying that your algebra is somehow home between these two things, or kind of deformation of home between these two things.
Yes. Because remember, this guy gives you the functor to vector spaces. To figure out the vertex algebra, we should see what does that functor do on the identity.
No, exactly. No, but I'm just trying to see why. How is that home related to sections of some kind?
Well, clearly, the intersection between these two subvariables is what I'm describing.
At the moment, I don't see that, but I'm probably just being too slow there.
Well, I mean, it is like literally maps, you know, right? Like, what's the intersection? It's maps which extend over the disk, but if you look at them as maps, not these
Okay. Fine. Well, but the line, I want to see the line bound.
They will be produced by geometric quantization.
Yes.
This is, the line bundle is a part of the kind of deformation business. Isn't it? Well, I mean, in other words, you don't need
quantization.
Is it true that the line, that they actually have to insert this line bundle in? I mean, I don't understand the word. Where exactly and for what reason you're going to use geometric quantization? So what I understood so far is that we have this story within the, in this kind of half-twisted theory, and the actual twisted theory is a deformation. So this line bundle, before the deformation, will the line bundle appear or not?
I think so.
Where? Because here you're considering home between two sort of objects, and none of which the line bundle plane.
Maybe when we said all, that was not right.
Maybe it should have been similar. I mean, so before you should, if you look at this, the algebra, you notice it has two invariant pairings. One which pairs G with G star, one which pairs G with itself. So in the half twist, the one which pairs G with G star goes away. You still have the one which pairs G with itself. So I think that's the kind of thing you can see.
But does it mean that this definition of bound advantage is not completely correct? I have to change it? Is that?
There's going to be. I mean, here this, I don't know exactly where the arrow will go.
Okay, well, this is homework.
Yeah, but it's the kind of usual thing that appears in front of the
chat. You know, I'm a little overwhelmed. So. So, but
we need to understand the geometric quantization categorical better.
Yeah. Can I ask the last question? So, why do you say the word geometric quantization? I mean, at least I don't, in anything you said so far, I don't recognize anything related to geometric quantization or to any quantization.
So, see, what are local operators?
Yeah.
So, if you do things very perturbatively, you might think that local operators are just, in a classical field theory, right?
Yeah.
Are just polynomials in your fields and derivatives of the fields. Unfortunately, that's not good enough. If you try to describe Chern-Simons theory or anything like this B-twist, you're gonna miss most of the interesting stuff at the boundary.
Okay.
The alternative is to think about local operators by state operator map as states on a hemisphere or a sphere. But then you need to be able to compute spaces of states. So you need quantization. Geometric quantization. So.
If you can beat the phase space, you'll literally see the cotangent bundle of this kind of funny FLS9.
You mean if you want to describe quantum theory, then you...
That's right, classical calculation.
So whom do you want to geometrically quantize here?
The phase space, which is the space of solutions to the equations of motion on the hemisphere.
Which in this kind of algebraic terms will be what? I mean, just...
So on the disk...
Hemisphere will be disk, right?
Disk of the boundary?
Yes.
So if the equations of motion say we have some kind of flat bundle or some kind of bundle on the disk, and then the boundary condition will be that it's trivial on the boundary. So we're going to get something like the algebraic.
So, okay, well, again, I have to think about it.
The reason that it's a line bundle, or a quantization, is that the line bundle has a twisted branch.
because we have this shift by 1, it doesn't seem to appear in the category. Is that not clear?
It's the more physics of the
category. Yeah. But if you look at the home space, it's not really obvious. You might describe your objects passively by some varieties. The home space in between them would be some sort of project, some sort of active variable. And as quantization, you would then
get the home space, you would change
your as that. And then would be some shifting. Now I have this thing of the space.
I'd be very happy to see somebody compute the vertex algebra.
This global way.
Yes.
Yeah, I agree, yeah.
Also, I mean, in the abelian case, like in principle, one should be able to just prove the vertex algebra is an isomorphic.
Yes.
For every abelian case.
That's right.
Nice.
Those mentioning V is star C.
But again, so you're saying that at least in abelian case, so you have a construction of some other boundary condition in sort of A, under the A deformation, so to say, which presumably is supposed to be mirror dual to this one.
Yes.
And you have it only in the abelian case.
Yes. I've been trying hard with Tadashi Okazaki to produce conjectures of non-abelian cases. We have some conjecture which typically involve the sort of Dreyfus circle of reduction of the algebra on the B side being equal to the one on the A side of the domain. But the calculations are just
First we have to define something on the A side.
We have something on the A side.
You do have something on the A side unconditionally.
Yes. We don't expect it to be isomorphic.
I see. So far it describes some kind of universal construction on the B side, and you have also some other universal construction on the A side,
yes,
which in the abelian case you're saying match under mirror symmetry,
mm-hmm.
But in general it's not clear how they match under mirror
symmetry. So if you give me an SU2 embedding into G, you can do some Dreyfus local modification of this, so you really get a family level by SU2 embedding. And on the other side, it was the choice of a fermionic representation.
Mm-hmm.
So it could be that some elements of these two families match. Where, in principle, you can get more general boundary conditions, so you add by hand extra degrees of freedom at the boundary. You can definitely do it in the holomorphic twist. It's far from clear when you will be able to deform them. I don't have a criterion. So there could be more general constructions, but we don't know them. And they might be needed to do mirror symmetric things. It would be also nice to have a session devoted to the 4D clinical force of Graham Mills version of all of this.
Absolutely, yeah.
But I guess there would be now the factorization 2 category, which is the local geometric Lagrange. And you can make it talk with this stuff.
Sorry, say it again.
So at some point, it would be nice to sort of discuss a bit the 4D version of this.
Which version?
4D.
4D.
So you have now each two things valid in a factorization algebra.
That's a lot of dimensions.
No, this is fine, but I mean, especially...
Just making a to-do thing, to-do list of...
Yeah, it will be also nice if you can do some interesting stuff which sort of leaves them on any level so that you have some kind of, not two things, not like A and B, but kind of whole P1 family or such things.
Yes.
Maybe this is too much to ask.
No, you're right. So if when you go to 4D, that's true. There will be a P1 family, which is special.
No, I mean, there will be a P1 family theories, but what the boundary conditions, you can also do this. I mean, we're going to discuss this a little bit. That's about,
yeah.
You can, but at least, right, but again, they would ask this question. I mean, here I said that for A and B, you have some universal construction on A side and universal construction on B side, but they don't really mesh. So somehow,
yes.
So therefore, there's no chance that you will actually produce it. P1 family because. No, maybe actually, sorry.
No. I mean, the way I'm trying to produce things that match is precisely by sort of. In 4D, there are many more things that can be matched. So if you learn how to build up 3D things out of 4D, you can build more things.